cool to be.
I'd
the same
like
way.
Us all to be one big.
Not necessarily the most politically.
I surely don't need to tell you.
Has it really changed your life? That
you've let somebody drill into you.
It's Ouch Edition 102 for November 2013, and if you're a first-time listener, then we're a podcast that does disability a little differently. I'm Rob, and boy, is it nice to see your lovely face. We'll be talking to Johnny Benjamin, a 26-year-old who has been posting videos to YouTube about his depression and the voices he hears. Why does he choose to share so much on the internet? We'll be asking him that and more in 20 minutes. Now, wearable technology seems to be the next big digital thing, as I accurately call it, so how will innovations like Google Glass and others help disabled people? We'll be gazing into the short-term future to see what's coming our way and if our little worlds will be significantly enhanced because of it. And music comes from one of our favourite learning disability bands, Fish Police, and in a few short seconds you can meet the two guests who are going to help us rifle through some recent news, fluff and detritus. We're not on the proper radio for nothing, you know. Stay tuned.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
Except, of course, Kate Monaghan, it is my sad and sombre duty to inform you, is not dead, just slightly ill. However, I do have two faithful hounds with me to go through the first part of the show, so it's my glorious duty to announce the presence right here in Studio 80A of Broadcasting House in London of Simon Minty and Tim Renkow. Hello to you both.
Hi, Rob.
Scholars of comedy you both are, and I first of all I want you to just to help me a little bit with something, as I'm having a minor existential crisis in the sense of, why am I here? Why do we do this show? Disability, why? It's a salient point, I feel, and I've just come up with a couple of questions basically about the whole oeuvre of disability, and I'm going to ask these questions to every single guest that comes on the show from now on. And essentially, until eventually, I get the right and true answer to the meaning of life. So the first one, is this a good question? Do you think disability is just a state of mind? Is that even answerable? Very quickly, first thing that comes to your mind.
Half of it, yeah. Not all of it.
Would you rather have your current disability for the rest of your life, or swap it for a year's worth of not being able to move in a hospital bed, and why? Validity, zero. I'm starting to think these questions are appalling.
The sort of swapping your impairment idea is quite an interesting one. Is this coming from where you are at the moment? These questions, ones you're
asking yourself?
Well,
sort of, yes. I must say. Okay, well, all right, let's go through these quickly. My other kind of existential angst question is, what date would you say disabled people will gain full equality? When? Can we actually answer that on a quantitative basis? As
no.
In July the 2nd, 2024?
I think that's a silly question. I think it's kind of built into disability that we'll never have equal... equality would be weird, because if it was totally equal for disabled people, it wouldn't be equal for non-disabled people, and thus it would never be equal.
So in that sense, non-disability would actually become a disability.
Yeah, and then it wouldn't be equal again.
Right, that's made my brain hurt quite a lot. But let's go back to the first point. It's silly. Do you acquiesce with this, Simon?
Yes, I do. I think you're looking at a very narrow definition of what equality might mean, and that's where Tim's saying, well, what is it broader than that? Then that starts to get more.
I'm looking for a killer question here. I really don't think I've nailed it. All right, one more. Which is my personal favourite. Would your life be better if you weren't disabled? I think that's a good question. Because, ultimately, I think a lot of people would grudgingly say, you know what, yes, it would. It would be loads better. Can I winkle this fact out of people?
Well, the problem is, that's kind of saying, do you like who you are?
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the whole point. Exactly. It's about people's self-esteem.
I don't think it's a valid quote, because it's not... Like, I wouldn't be the same person if I wasn't disabled.
Yeah, but you might be a better person.
But I wouldn't be the same person.
That's okay.
And Tim and I, sort of, this is how we came out.
I lose so much of my material.
Yeah. Comedians always worry about losing material by a cure.
Yeah. You would go down to work a solid 5 minutes of material, I suppose. Yeah, that makes sense. And also, I wouldn't have this to do one day a month either.
If I was not disabled, aren't there times that I like myself more and sometimes I don't? And are there things, even without a disability, I'd like to change about myself? So I don't know whether... Is that not good for everybody?
The puzzle is an endless and intensely difficult one. So listeners will already know, Simon, if you're ardent fans of this programme. So I'm just going to turn to Tim for a moment. Let me physically turn to the other side of the table. Now, Tim, you're a stand-up comedian, and you were at the Edinburgh Fringe this summer, and also featured in Fresh from the Fringe on Radio 4. Here's a quick clip so listeners can hear your shtick.
So I know what you're thinking... And that is insanely offensive. I'm from the Deep South, and the crazy people always come up to me and talk about Jesus, which gets so boring. Because since you don't have Jesus, it means your crazy people get creative. I had this woman come up to me and go, "Excuse me, sir, do you have cerebral palsy?" And I went, "Yeah, I do." And she goes, "Right, my brother had that. He died from it." And then she just stopped talking. That was the end of the conversation.
So this happens quite a lot then, Tim. You're approached by Christians, but is this mostly when you're in the States, or does this happen in Britain too?
Mostly in the States. I had one lady that she came up trying to comfort me. The opening line was, "Excuse me, do you have MS? And I went, "No, I don't." And that kind of messed her up. So she panicked and just left. Before she left, she goes,
But what do they want to do? How do they come across?
I think it's because... Well, the joke I have about it, which is...
Yeah, go on, just read your material.
...offensive, but I think also they feel, which they're correct, they feel that because of the disability, I have a... Like, legitimacy for hating God. That's what they
are. Oh, I see.
Say
they assume you're going to be a rampant atheist because of your condition.
Which I am, but it's not because I'm my condition. It's because I'm an anarchist, which is different, but yeah.
And there are so many comedians with cerebral palsy. Yeah. Listing a few, right, there's Josh Blue, there's Lawrence Clark, there's Francesca Martinez, Maysoon Zaid, there's Jack Carroll. If you don't know him, he's the 14-year-old finalist on this year's Britain's Got Talent.
I rode down an elevator with him.
Is that you did?
Yeah, he is a very nice walker.
A great walker. With a certain sort of showbiz panache.
Well, yeah, it has a seat attached. I really want his walker.
He's a very nice walker.
He's funny too, but his walker is unbelievable.
Is there a bit of walk envy here?
I think so.
Yeah, huge. So, and you also might remember, I'm just going to continue this slightly dull list, which my producer is forcing me to read. Australian Steady Eddie, Ted Shiraz and Lost Voice Guy. Right, done that. Yeah. So many CPers have real issues communicating, I suppose. So I'm just wondering, Tim, why would you throw yourself on the line in front of a comedy audience?
I think, I can only speak for me, because I can't do voices. I think it was all just the only thing I was good at, really.
And have you ever had experiences in where people have literally said, "Pardon? Can you say that again, mate?" Have you had heckles like that from audiences?
No, the worst heckle usually if people don't, because that just makes it seem like a joke in front of it. So I've had people normally, if they're gonna do stuff like that, come up to you after the show and tell you, Like, I had one guy
come... Oh, so you get more sort of one-to-one criticism rather than mass abuse.
I had one guy come up to me after the show and tell me, you were funny, but I was too uncomfortable to laugh. It's like, why would you tell me that? Like, what good in... How am I going to use that information?
And this is something that I feel a lot of people with disabilities have.
When they do it to me, I always just make them buy me the most expensive drink in the pub.
Exactly, please. Yeah, just take it out on alcohol.
Just use it.
Right, now, buses. That was a good link, wasn't it? That was really seamless segue into the next bit of news. So last month we mentioned how Doug Pawley won an 18-month legal battle against First Buses in Yorkshire. A mum with a baby in a pushchair refused to vacate the wheelchair space in case it woke her child, and the driver refused to insist that she move. Now, Doug won over £5,000 compensation because the judge ruled that it was in breach of the 2010 Equality Act. Now, the news this month is that the bus company is going to appeal this decision, and disability groups are rather surprised and upset about it. So let's pass this over to Simon. Now, why do disabled people trump mums with buggies? I mean, shouldn't it be sort of just first come, first served?
I get really ratty when I read this story. I mean, it's back up on the BBC website because of the right to appeal. As the judge said, the government and our country has chosen to protect disabled people's rights. There is no protection for parents with buggies. That is not part of the law. And I think the other bit is the wheelchair...
So the only reason is not actually because of any sort of moral reason or anything like that. It's purely because there's a law in place for disabled people and there isn't a law in place for mothers. That's it.
I found that when the legislation came in, DDA and then... Or Disability Discrimination Act turned into the Equality Act, we all became a lot more moral. The problem is if you rely on that kind-heartedness, then it might not always come. And even in this case, so no, the point was it was taken to a court, so obviously the judge or the tribunal chair has got to say, I'm basing this on what the law of the land is. That's the whole point. But Mumsnet, which is the sort of network for parents and particularly mothers, obviously, they agreed with this. They said we should give this up for a wheelchair user. So there's not really a lot of debate. It's just that the buses were not enforcing a policy. And I know, well, Tim may know it as well. I'm travelling in San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Hong Kong. I was even on Eurostar recently, and the conductor or the guy who let me on into the wheelchair spot, people were moaning, saying, oh, I want to put my bags there, I want to put my luggage there. And he said, I'm sorry, this is for a wheelchair user. So my bit is, if there's no... The wheelchair user doesn't have anywhere else to sit. And if they're trying to encourage everybody to get back on public transport, there's nothing more unsettling to get on and think you've got nowhere to be.
And also actually face the hostility of other people who want to put their tote bag where your wheelchair or crutches or whatever happened to be.
One of the nicest feelings I get is going on public transport, particularly when I'm abroad and San Francisco is one, and then you get on and there's a guy with a bike or, I don't know, maybe a mum with a pushchair, and they look at you, see you come on, they smile and they move out of the way and you go, thank you very much. And maybe you squeeze up a little bit so they can share it. But it's just polite and lovely.
What about you, Tim? Do you think it should be first come, first served?
I always give up first come, first serve for a baby because I feel I'm physically stronger than a baby and I can wait for the next bus.
So this is interesting. So you're happy to do that?
Yeah, that means that if the baby can fold up the buggy, you need to fold up your buggy because it's polite. But
are the mothers ever grateful for your little sacrifice?
No. Mothers are... A word I can't use on BBC, but some of them get it. But that means that if I'm on the bus and a baby comes on, the baby's out of luck, unless it's raining. I might get off if it's a cold day.
So, Simon, this is what it boils down to. is it hurling down outside or not? In San Francisco and Hong Kong, probably less likely than Leeds.
Although they can get very heavy rain, but I take your point. Maybe this is my bit, because I don't know why I was quite so angry. I thought maybe I'm missing something here. They did have the policy of first come, first serve. But do you use a wheelchair, Tim? I mean,
I do.
So you have only one option, and that...
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but I'm used, like... I didn't realise it was the law. Like,
right.
I think if it's the law, you can't make an exception, because that...
Look how the law has destroyed Tim's sense of benevolence and kindness.
Personally, you should, but, like, the judge can't make an exception.
What happened if six buses came along, and every single one of them, the wheelchair spot's taken because of a parent and a buggy? Do you keep saying, fair enough, I'll wait?
I'll
just move somewhere with less kids.
That's kind of, well, you're a better man than me than
I'm very impressed.
I'm quite up to sort of going on and saying, look, let's see how we can negotiate this and share it
What, I give you money to leave? Is this what you're thinking?
No. I still think a parent with a buggy, the judge said it does inconvenience them. We know that. But I think there is a negotiation where you sort of say, how can we squeeze in? I don't want to be...
The thing, if you can squeeze in.
Right.
I think it's the mother's duty to try squeeze as hard as she...
Because one thing
the excuse, I'm going to wake my baby up, is not a valid excuse.
I think the way to the bit for me is there another alternative for the wheelchair user, the disabled person to go to? Mm. And if there is no alternative, there's only one spot on the bus, there's only one loo, that's when I think we should take priority. That's the distinction.
And is the mother capable of actually folding up the buggy? Which in 99 out of 100 cases you would assume, she could, actually.
Yes.
So anyway, this could go on for ages, but we're going to move on to the final section of this little part of the show. Now, 27-year-old blind singer Andrea Begley, she was the surprise winner of BBC One's The Voice UK in June. So flash forward for 4 months, and ladies and gentlemen, she's brought out not only her first album, but also an autobiography at 27. Now, they often have, make of that what you will. Now, autobiographies often have rather cheap, easy pun-laden titles, and hers is no different. It's available from all good, bad, and mediocre bookshops right now, and it's called, wait for it, I Didn't See That Coming. Also out last month, I should also point out, was Werewolf, My Story by David the Werewolf. Slightly better-ish. A little bit of effort went into that. But anyway, before you two depart, I've devised a fun quiz for you both. I'm going to read out some autobiography titles written by disabled celebs, and you have got to tell me who you think wrote them. And the clues, and the very obvious clues, are in the titles. Is this understood? Present. Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Excellent. Who do you think wrote My Brief History?
I know.
Go on.
Stephen Hawkins.
Boom, he's got it. Next one. Who do you think wrote Seize the Day?
Somebody with seizures.
You're right, that's actually thinking a little bit too cleverly, though, because it was actually Tammy Gray Thompson.
Of course it is.
Now, who wrote Lucky Man, which was followed up with Always Looking Up and A Funny Thing Happened to Me on the Way to the Future?
Michael J. Fox.
He's there, man Minty. Okay, we've got four more. Who do you think wrote Tongue Tied, Subnormality in the 70s?
Joey Deacon.
You are blitzing. He's on fire, Joey Deacon.
Well, there are quite a lot of UK people here.
Sorry, Tim. But I think this is... If you have very long memories, you may remember Joey Deacon was on children's TV show Blue Peter back in the 70s. He was kind of wheeled out as a man with cerebral palsy, and he was sort of stared at by children in a way which probably wouldn't be considered acceptable today.
I saw a documentary on him.
On Joey. Is he still alive? Is he still going?
I don't know.
Don't know.
The documentary.
No, he died in 1981.
Oh,
wow. Just proves how out of date I am. Right, three more. And one of them I think Tim's going to get, but probably not this next one. Who wrote On a Clear Day?
I think it's Vision.
Yes, you are right.
Stevie Wonder.
No, this is a Brit. Beard, politician.
Oh, David Blunkett.
Got it. Okay, right. This is one which I'm really hoping you're going to get, Tim. Who wrote Wishful Drinking?
Ooh. sounds like something I would
She played Princess Leia.
Oh, Carrie Underwood.
Underwood. You did say Carrie, right?
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher.
I love doing names.
I thought she was Postcards from the Edge.
Is that another one that she's written?
Yeah, that was a really famous one. People are going to like that.
In the current autobiography market, if you're over 30, you've probably written about seven autobiographies by now. This one was written in 2009, Wishful Drinking. She has, as you may already know, manic depression. She's a strong advocate of ECT, which she has benefited from, and as the title suggests, is an alcoholic. And the very final one, published in 1999, this is a little bit of an incestuous option, I must say, within the BBC, who wrote See It My Way?
Peter White.
Peter White, the beloved presenter of BBC Radio 4's In Touch programme. Tim, you sucked, but on the other hand, you are American. Simon, you're a goody two-shoes. You did incredibly well there. So I would like to thank you both hugely for being on the show with me today, especially me here on my own. Tweet us at BBCOuch or email ouch@bbc.co.uk. Maybe you want to be on a future show or think we should know about something. We're also looking for Ouch correspondence as well. Almost certainly no money in it, but we'd like to hear from you. Do you have an area of interest in the disability field that we could, well, how can I put this, take advantage of? I'd quite like to think of a disability travel correspondent we could have, or maybe a disability gig correspondent or whatever. So if this appeals, if this floats your boat or lights your ring, then do get in touch now at email. Again, it's ouch@bbc.co.uk. And thank you very, very much to Simon Minty and Tim Renkow.
Ouch. Talking disability.
I put myself on a dating site once and I didn't mention that I had a disability, and I got loads and loads of emails asking for dates and stuff. Obviously, I had to tell them I had a disability, and then there was just like no more emails. I put myself on as having a disability and I just didn't get any emails whatsoever, so I think it is very image orientated.
bbc.co.uk/ouch.
Do you remember this?
Dishwater, not dishwater.
Or this?
Japanese girl.
Well, now there's this.
The very first time she spoke to me, never forget. Just what she said to me, something like,
hey, hey, stop looking at me, will you?
It's the Fish Police, and they're back with Sabrin, My Very Last Day, which you can hear in full at the end of this show. We've got Johnny Benjamin with us. He's on the line from Salford. Hello, Johnny.
Hiya.
Now, 26-year-old Johnny Benjamin, let's just tell you a little bit about you before we crack on with the conversation. Now, Johnny, for the benefit of listeners, makes YouTube videos about living with mental illness. In his case, it's schizoaffective disorder, a mix between schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And now the videos are much talked about and much shared. Apparently Stephen Fry retweeted one of the links very, very recently. It's led to an award from the charity Rethink to acknowledge his positive contribution. You also may have seen Johnny earlier this year on BBC Three fronting a programme in the Mad World season. So, Johnny, I'm going to play a clip of one of your videos in a second, but firstly, did I explain schizoaffective disorder adequately, or is there something or anything you want to add to that?
No, yeah, you explained it adequately. I think for me, I didn't have the bipolar as such. I just had the depression. Other people get the highs and the lows that come with bipolar, but for me, it was just always lows. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's schizoaffective disorder in terms of schizophrenia and depression, I think.
So here's a clip from one of your videos. This is one of your more recent ones, I think, and in it, you're explaining the voices that you hear.
Sure.
Sometimes I get intrusive thoughts.
Throw the glass of water, Johnny. Throw the glass of water in his face. Imagine the water all over his face. Pick it up. Pick up the glass now. Pick up the glass, Johnny, and throw it in his face. Come on, Johnny. Throw the glass of water in his face. You can do it. Come on, imagine it. Do it. Do it. Pick up the glass of water. Come on, throw it in his face. Imagine the water all over his face. You can do it, Johnny. Come on, pick it up. Pick up the glass.
Tell us about these voices, Johnny. Who are these people? Do you have a relationship with them? Who are they?
Well, I know now that they're just my voices inside my head. Before I was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, I thought they were an external voice. I actually thought it was, first of all, I thought it was an angel that was talking to me. And then I thought it was a devil that was talking to
me. And this started when you were very young or a teenager?
When I was 10, I started hearing a voice for the first time.
And how did you react when it first began? Was it fear? Or?
No, actually, because it was an angel, I actually quite liked it being there. Because I was quite religious at the time. I come from a Jewish background, and I went to a Jewish school, and I thought I was blessed to have this angel in my head. So
It doesn't seem like you questioned it, though. It seems like you were quite accepting of it being there.
Well, I thought that everyone heard this voice in their head. I just thought it was natural. It was part of being human. So to find out that I was actually wrong, and that actually it was considered an illness to have a voice in your head, was very strange to me. I've kind of got used to it over the years. I don't mind it being there so much. It doesn't overwhelm me like it used to. When it got really bad, when I started hearing this devil, it was very controlling. And now I feel I'm in control, to an extent, of the voice.
A lot of approaches to schizophrenia suggest that people who have the condition should speak back to them or form a friendship of sorts. I mean, is that what you've tried to do?
Kind of. I use something called mindfulness that's really helped me, and that's all about getting into your body, doing things like yoga and meditation, and really getting into your body and remembering that your mind and your body are connected. So when I start hearing voices and they overwhelm me, I just go into my body and maybe focus on something like the soles of my feet, so that disconnects so much from what I'm hearing in my head. It does require practice, but it's definitely worth it, I'd say.
So tell me about an average day then. What about today, since before you began speaking to me? Tell me what went through any voices this morning?
I was in work this morning, and I went to Starbucks with a colleague. And as soon as I got given my cup of tea, I heard something in my head say, throw that over the person sitting there. And then walking around with my tea, it was just constant, like, throw it over them, throw it over that person there.
I would really like you, during the course of the conversation we're having, if you don't mind, I'd really like you, if you do start hearing voices while we're talking, do feel free to interrupt me and tell me if you're comfortable with that, because I'd really like to know how it feels.
There's always something there, especially when I'm doing something like this. I always hear something saying, you're not good enough, or you're wasting that person's time, or I don't know if we all get that, but I certainly get that.
Are you getting that right this very second?
Not right this very second, but I have heard it since we've been talking. It's quite interesting. I read an interview with Anthony Hopkins, or Sir Anthony Hopkins, and he also hears this voice that says to him, yeah, you're not good enough. And he's playing something like Macbeth, and he's on stage and in front of hundreds of people, and this voice in his head is saying, you're not good enough, you can't do this, you can't do Shakespeare. And I found that fascinating.
Absolutely.
When I read that. And it comforted me in a way, because I always hear this voice saying I'm not good enough, or what I'm saying is rubbish.
We certainly think that you're worth talking to. I should definitely point that out.
I kind of think of my mind as having Tourette's almost, because a lot of the things that come into my head, they're not really me. This is going to sound really kind of cheesy, but it's not who I am kind of in my heart, because I think I'm a good person. I've had some just ridiculous thoughts, you know, pushing prams downstairs, you know, when you're going down escalators to the tube or something. If there's a pram there, it's always in my head going, push that pram down or something. And that's not me, you know.
But have there been any moments in your 26 years, well, since you've had it, which I guess would be, what, about 15 years, since you've acted upon it and you've lost control and you have thrown a cup of water in someone's face? I mean, has that often happened?
No, I haven't. Not yet. No, which is why something like the meditation and the yoga is so important. If I didn't do those things, then, gosh, I don't know. I think I would be very tempted to, because it's so overwhelming at times. And it feels like there's nothing else around you. It's just what's in your head that's taking place.
And this is the thing. I mean, so many people have a fear, shall we say, of so many sorts of disabilities. People sometimes are uncomfortable about being with someone in a wheelchair. They're scared of what they could say and what they could do wrong. But schizophrenia seems to have particularly pejorative connotations. I mean, is this something that is an issue to you, that you feel that people are going to be scared of you?
To be honest, I'm quite lucky. I haven't really encountered too much stigma, because I'm so open. People are quite open with me. I'm usually quite honest, especially with things like paranoia. Someone that I, I'm really close to, I'll be able to tell them if I'm struggling with paranoia. And they don't always understand it, but they can at least kind of show support and empathy.
Well, we've got another clip now, which we're going to listen to. These are very, very engaging and quite gripping videos. Have a listen to this.
Being to the cinema to see the film The Truman Show with Jim Carrey. In the film, Jim Carrey's character is watched by cameras all around. Nothing in his life is real. Everyone's an actor, and every scenario is fabricated by a director. He's watched by millions of people across the world, and he's the only one that doesn't know it. When we came out of the cinema, my friend said to me, well, maybe that could be you, but you wouldn't know it. And I began to really dwell on this, and I thought, well, it could be happening to me. But I just would have no idea.
Well, The Truman Show came out in 1998, so that would have made you 11 or 12 years old when it came out.
Yeah.
It's extremely young. I mean, is this something that you're still thinking about at the moment, that perhaps The Truman Show is occurring to you?
No, I think, because I went into hospital when I was 20, and that was the point when I realised that I'd been in this kind of delusion for the past 10 years. And when the psychiatrist I saw explained to me that it was all in my head, that was a major kind of awakening for me. And then I realised that I'd been in this delusion, and so that doesn't occur for me anymore, that whole perception that I'm in my own version of The Truman Show.
But you're very, very far from being alone in this. I read a magazine article a couple of months ago about that in America, it's actually now a medically recognised condition called The Truman Show condition.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, have you ever met anybody else who shares this unpleasant fantasy based on this film?
No, I haven't actually. I haven't. I've heard lots of stories, particularly in America. There was someone that believed that 9/11 had been fabricated, and so he travelled from across the states, and he went to New York just to prove to himself that 9/11 was fabricated. And he turned up at the where the Twin Towers was,
at Ground Zero.
Ground Zero, yeah. And then suddenly he realised that he was. In a kind of delusion. It must have been a massive shock to him, you know. And then this is quite common. There's been other things. There's someone in America went to the immigration office and said something like, you know, you need to help me get out of here because I'm trapped in the US. I want to get away from the cameras. People out there are walking around believing they're part of this reality show, and. It's quite amazing is the wrong word, but it's quite amazing the impact that a film like The Truman Show has had on people. I think something like X Factor, for me, I need to kind of limit how much I watch something like X Factor, because it can make me delusional and think that, oh, I can maybe be a singer, or I can get this record deal. And with all these reality shows out there, I need to be careful. And I think anyone with schizophrenia needs to be careful about how much they watch of these things. I know lots of people with schizophrenia who say that they feel that they're getting messages from things they watch on TV, particularly from reality shows, particularly like X Factor, where you can get this record deal and you can... I see a lot of young people, especially on things like Twitter and social media in general, really kind of buying into this whole thing of becoming famous instantly, and I see a lot of them being quite delusional, and that's quite worrying.
But I mean, the idea obviously is that the contestants who go on the X Factor obviously want the kind of fame that you describe, though, aren't they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But that's kind of worrying in itself. I just see a lot of young people kind of losing their own identity, and well, not just young people, but people of all ages, kind of losing their identity and wanting to become something they're not. And I suppose that's, I can relate to that, because I thought I was something that I wasn't when I was on this kind of whole version of The Truman Show.
You're extremely open about this topic. I mean, is it a good idea sharing like this? I'm thinking really about how your job prospects can be affected by, you know, the things that you've said on Facebook, your videos on YouTube. You know, some people might want to avoid you or perhaps not give you a job. I mean, is this something that concerns you?
It doesn't concern me too much. I'd rather be open about my mental health and, you know, hide it away. Because I suffered so much growing up, because I kept everything silent, that I could never go through that again. I feel like I have to be open and honest now, just for my own health, really. So, I mean, I'm... When it comes to something like a job situation, I am reluctant to disclose my mental health issues, but I think it's beneficial that I do, to be honest, so that people are aware.
Yeah. Well, how has employment been for you?
It's been mixed.
I know you used to work at Harrods for a while. Was that a particularly bad experience?
Yeah,
for you?
It was a bad experience.
Tell me about that.
Well, I ended up walking out after a week. Because I couldn't handle it.
What couldn't you handle?
It was very stressful and very competitive amongst staff, and I really struggled with learning everything so quickly,
and did this paranoia trigger voices to become more and more loud and overwhelming?
Yeah, and paranoia and things like that. So. I literally only spent a week there, and I just walked out one afternoon when it was just all too much. So I need to be really careful of how much kind of stress I take on in my work.
Is that typical, though? I mean, you've had jobs that where you've lasted more than a week, I'm presuming.
Yeah, no, I have. And I try and deal with stress. I mean, every job comes with stress, but I try and manage it to an extent, but it's really hard. And I have to... do things like mindfulness and meditation and other things like that to keep on top of my stress levels and my mental health.
So do you disclose your mental health condition when you're applying for jobs?
I haven't done. No, I haven't actually. Just because I just don't want the judgment, really. You know, the job market's so tough as it is.
Yeah.
That I don't want to kind of limit... what people think that I can do.
So you do expect, I mean, you said in your personal life you haven't really had that much in the way of, you know, people being scared of you or had any sort of bizarre reactions, but in the field of employment it seems as if it's much tougher.
Well, I think so. I think it is, because people will probably, you know, think about, oh, that person's more likely to take time off for being sick. It's very different when it comes to employment, I think. Much different to kind of a social situation. You're being judged, aren't you, all the time in employment. So, whereas, you know, when you're with your friends, they kind of, they know you and they know what to expect and they don't judge you so much.
What about if someone else listening to this is experiencing anything like what you've been through in the last 10, 15 years? I mean, what should they do right now to help themselves?
Well, I mean, first of all, if they've never disclosed it to anyone, I'd say talk to someone about what you're going through. You know, don't keep it to yourself. Whether that be a friend or a family member or someone professional such as a GP, I think it's so important to talk to someone about it and not keep it all to yourself. Also to do other things such as writing, maybe, because it can be so overwhelming and intense just keeping it all inside. So there's other kind of mental health charities out there such as Mind or maybe the Samaritans. Lots of people out there who are willing to listen and support you, basically, so you're not alone.
Well, I really appreciate your honesty and your openness. Thank you so much for speaking to us today, Johnny. We've got links to your YouTube page and articles about you on our blog, bbc.co.uk/ouch. And if this has rung bells with you, or you'd like to tell us about your own experiences or any projects you're involved with, then you can tweet us at bbcouch. You can find us on Facebook, or you can email us at ouch@bbc.co.uk. So once again, Johnny, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Who is Rob Crossan?
Well, being a kid and having albinism, I rather enjoyed it. I was always quite a forthright, cocky little child who teachers, on the whole, utterly loathed. I really liked the fact that being an albino, first of all, got me out of loads of trouble. And believe me, there were plenty of times when I blamed my behaviour on the fact that I'm upset about my albinism. And I was that emotionally manipulative at about the age of 7, which really doesn't paint me in a very good light at all. But it did get me out of lots of trouble. And it also got me loads of attention. And I loved the attention of it. And I was quite happy to turn it on its head and do all the things that people didn't expect me to do. I was always given the choice of not playing sports, you know. But I really enjoyed it. I just did whatever the hell I wanted to do. Cycling around dark country lanes outside of Ellesmere Port as a kid with no bike lights, no helmets, and just not being able to see a thing. I'm really grateful to my parents. They could have mollycoddled me, but they were quite happy to let me go out into the world and figure out for myself what I could and couldn't do.
The Ouch Talk Show.
On the line from our studio in Coventry, we've got Robin Christofferson. Hello, Robin.
Hello there.
Hello. Now, you're head of inclusion at AbilityNet, and you are, I take it, a huge advocate of technology.
I am, yep, head of digital inclusion, and AbilityNet, for people who aren't aware, is the UK's leading expert organisation on all things technology and disability, which is actually quite easy to say because we're the only organisation that is truly pan-disability, all kinds of disability impairments, including RSI and dyslexia and that sort of thing, and all kinds of technology.
You stand alone. And with me making noises in the background, we've dragged in Emma Tracy, doyen of this show. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
And Tim and Simon are still with us as well. Hello to you both. Hey. Now, they're all back to keep me company. So today we're going to talk about where we are with technology that can help people with disabilities and what's just around the corner, and really just find a date on this, because there's always these, you know, ideas floating around, and I'd really like to just get something a little bit more concrete. So firstly, to everyone gathered around the table here with me, when thinking about your disability and overcoming problems that other people don't have, is technology or assistive technology a big part of your life? Let's just take this one by one. So Tim, big, medium, tiny?
I'd say medium.
Medium. Emma?
Huge.
Colossal. And Simon?
Medium at the moment.
Medium, okay. So Robin, status update then. How far have we come in the last 10 years or so?
Well, going back to the sort of 80s where the PC, you know, the advent of the PC came along and really opened doors for so many people, particularly people with disabilities. You know, I owe my education to the fact that there was technology around. I can't see myself at all. So I rely on speech output and braille. But then a couple of years ago, or sort of 5 or 6 years ago now, particularly with the iPhone, the smartphone revolution was as significant, if not more so, because it took the power of computing and it made it mobile. It put it in everyone's pocket. It made it be with you, ever present. And because it's so smart, and we can talk about the different ways that it can be used by people with disabilities, it is there for you 24/7. So it couldn't be more huge.
So we've gone the timeline all the way through to now. So let's, what about the future then? I mean, I know wearable technology is something people seem to be talking a lot about at the moment, especially with Google Glass sort of tantalisingly on the horizon. So, Robin, can you tell us a little bit about wearable and about glass? I mean, why would this help disabled people in particular?
Absolutely. So Google I.O., which is their developer conference, last year promised this fantastic development, Google Glass, which is sort of a very geeky pair of glasses with a built-in heads-up display, which is a sort of a screen that when it's not on, you can see right through it. You can't tell it's there, but when it is, it's in your top right corner of vision and it can give you lots of useful information. And these are multimedia smart glasses with a built-in camera. So there's an awful lot of potential that it's got to, we can talk about, you know, exactly what those applications might be.
Like the promo video.
So the promo video that came out back in Google I.O. last year had lots of amazing things. The chap wakes up, he's got glass on. I wouldn't recommend sleeping in your glasses, but anyway, he looks at the clock on the wall and smart object recognition could tell that he was looking at the clock and it thought, ooh, he's obviously interested in the time. So it brought up on the heads-up display what his appointments were that morning. He looked out of the window and it could tell that he was doing that. And it, so it gave him the weather forecast. As he's walking down the street, it could detect that he's going into the subway, either through sort of geolocation or object recognition of the subway sign, but it tells him that the subway line is closed, and so it gives him turn-by-turn directions. And everyone was getting really excited by this sort of prospect. But then it didn't come into people's hands until 12 months later with these Explorer editions of glass. And it did actually deliver largely on what that promo video promised. And there are lots of things that it can do, like you can issue voice commands and it will take a picture, it will record a video, you can do...
So being entirely selfish here, as me, as someone who's visually impaired, would, if I'm walking down a street and it's extremely busy and I'm struggling to see where I'm going, would it warn me if I was about to bump into a lamppost or walk into a sheet of glass?
No, but there are smart glasses with haptic feedback that will do that, that guide dogs are working on. There's, since Glass kind of hit the scene, and because it's by Google, it's obviously, you know, caused many waves. And so there are loads of spin-off ones that can detect emotions, that can do facial recognition to tell you if, you know, there's someone with a criminal record in your vicinity. There's a whole range of things that are, you know, coming out as a result of this. But for people with a disability, and I've got a vision impairment myself, I'm really excited. You know, you might think, well, how could somebody who's blind be as excited about this as other people? You know, obviously I can't use the heads-up display, but this is a multimedia smart device. So it has speech synthesis. We know it can do, for example, real-time translation. It can hear people in your surroundings. It can turn that speech into text for people with a hearing impairment. It can give you real-time sort of subtitling up on the heads-up display for people who can't hear very well. It can translate that into other languages and have it spoken back to you.
Let's go back to what you said about emotional responses, because we asked on Twitter our followers what future tech they'd like. Lucy Seren tweeted to tell us that she wants something that could help her recognise and read people's faces, and she added the hashtag Asperger's at the end, so we have to assume that that's the condition that she has. Now, I'm very, very, very curious about this, because as far as I'm aware, you know, the face is a rather nuanced and complex thing, and just putting smiley faces at the end of texts, you know, that doesn't really adequately describe, you know, the emotion that someone might be feeling when they're writing something. I mean, is it as primitive as that with Google Glass and its competitors?
Very mature. So a UK company have designed a pair of glasses with a rice grain sized camera in them, and this software is very mature. So there's 24 points, facial points, which it uses to try and decide what the emotion is. And
this is because people with Asperger's find it difficult sometimes to recognise what kind of emotions they're eliciting in someone.
Certainly that was the driving force, but actually in tests it was shown to be more accurate than the human testers without any kind of impairment at all. 64% of the time it got it right, compared to 56% of the time for mere mortals. So like with so many of these things, there is a mainstream and a disability angle. And one of the things about mobile computing that is very, very significant is that when you're out and about, many people are temporarily disabled. I would argue everybody who uses a mobile device is temporarily disabled at some point during the day. Maybe you're driving, so you can't, you know, look at the screen for prolonged periods. You can't interact with it on the touchscreen very much. So you need to have options. You need to be able to have it spoken back to you. You need to be able to speak to it or have gestures that you can wave at it to do a particular action. And if you're in a bright sunlight, for example, it's difficult to see your mobile phone screen. So to have high contrast or to have speech output is really important. So if you're temporarily disabled, as you know, every single user, then you would take advantage of these features from time to time. But we just happen to be permanently disabled. So because those options are there, that makes it important for us. And it's the same with this emotion recognition. You know, whether it was designed for people, you know, whatever the origin was, whatever the reason, there are so many apps, there are so many functions of your smartphone that I personally don't care whether they were designed originally for people with an impairment or for a mainstream audience, because they're done in an inclusive way, I can use them. So one example is on my phone, I've got an app called Talking Goggles, which does real-time object recognition. And so I can point any product underneath it, and it's got a live video feed to the internet, and it's doing searches on every single image that's on the internet, and it will come back and speak that out to me. Barcodes, products, it can even do OCR, so it could read a letter to me. And it's instantaneous if you've got a good internet connection, and there's a bit of a lag if you're on 3G. But imagine that application, and that's not a disability-specific product. That's so that people can go into the supermarket and scan in something and then get some information about it, get some cooking suggestions, and see if it's they can get it cheap around the corner, that sort of thing.
But
for me, it's an absolute lifesaver.
When is this going to happen?
It's on my phone right
now. Already exists.
Absolutely. Talking Goggles. I can't remember how much it is. It's either free or it's like 99p, just like everything, you know, for mobile apps these days. Now, if you take that concept and you put it in glass that's on your head all the time, the camera is looking wherever you're looking, and you take those smarts and you, that artificial intelligence, that kind of object recognition, just like we saw in the original promo video, this is technology that is really quite mature now. And if you combine it with the multimedia capabilities of glass, then someone like myself, who hasn't got a pair of functioning eyes, I would have at least one eye that had, you know, really clever smarts behind it, looking wherever I'm looking, recognizing objects and speaking out to me. We know it's got speech output in the glasses, what I'm looking at, where I'm going, recognising things and giving me information about it. So I'm really, really excited.
Well, I do like the fact that, as you say, everybody is temporarily disabled at some point during the day. I find that such a great concept, the idea that everyone's getting a little taste of what I have at some point during the day. I think it's almost like getting 5 free web pages before you have to go behind the paywall. It's just a little amuse-bouche. I mean, are you looking forward to this, Emma? This world which Robin describes?
I am. I think something I'm really looking forward to would be really very good indoor navigation, and very navigation that's very much pinpoints where you are and what you're looking at, as Robin says. So to be honest, that's mostly so that I can get around the shopping centre and do shopping by myself, which isn't, it's not essential, but it's something that I can't do right now, and I can do most things, but, you know, go off to the shopping centre and do all my Christmas shopping is just not that easy. So I'd like really, really good indoor navigation.
So yeah, it seems like it's very blindly orientated, this discussion and all the benefits. So I'm going to ask Simon and Tim, does this have any relevance to you at all? Can you see it making your life easier in the years to come?
No, really. I think my head shakes too much for it to work properly for me.
Simon?
I think I'm a big fan of Robin, and I'm a big fan of AbilityNet, and I love hearing about this stuff because, there's sort of accidental things that will be very useful to me, just like they're useful to other people. I don't know what it might be yet, and what might be more specific. Can I ask a question? I'm kind of curious. Is there a leader in this, Robin, in terms of all the Microsofts or the Nokias or the Apples or the Googles and all of these people? Is there one that builds in disability more routinely, or some who are leading the way on this?
Absolutely. I mean, Apple has really forged the vanguard in this area. Everything in an iDevice is accessible. Everything, to the extent that in the Maps app, I, as a blind person, can trace my finger on roads and it will give me a certain sound. And if I go off the road, it will make another sound and it'll tell me if I'm coming up to a junction, and it'll say whether the name of the road and whether it's east-west or north-south or south-east or whatever it might be. The camera app, when you're taking a photograph of someone, it'll say crisp, but blurry, very, very blurry, one face, top left. And so I, as a blind person, can centre that face, make sure that it's focused, and I can take a decent picture. For people with other disabilities, there is everything in there. You can control an iOS device completely from a single switch, for example. There's lots of stuff in there for hearing. It can drive a range of different hearing aids. So literally, there are drivers in there for braille displays and hearing aids where it can communicate directly with the device, so you don't get any external interference at all. Unfortunately, Google Glass doesn't have drivers for these other external peripherals yet, and that's something that we're advocating very hard for. But Apple is benefiting hugely from, you know, the love from the disabled community at large, because they are very, very inclusive.
They're embracing it more than Google are, in your opinion?
Google are playing catch up. I think they've been sort of embarrassed into, TalkBack, for example, which is the equivalent speech output on Android, is slowly, you know, closing the gap. But federal procurement, being able to purchase, you know, thousands of iPads for the education sector in a given state, it's Apple every single time, because they have laws that say, you know, if you're going to procure lots of devices, they need to be inclusive. And Apple has traditionally been the only ones that are truly inclusive.
Right, now, some of the headlines which we see, I really need you to help me flesh these out, Robin, because some of the ones I've seen recently, they involve things like paralysed people or people with locked-in syndrome being able to control computers with their minds. Now, is it possible to almost get telepathic with your iPad or your PC? I mean, it just seems like bananas science fiction. I mean, is this imminent or already happening?
It absolutely is imminent. There's a European project called BrainAble that AbilityNet are involved in, which is being able to control a computer or a prosthesis or a whole robotic exoskeleton just from thought, just from brainwaves. The most successful interface at the moment is an invasive one where you have to undergo surgery and have things implanted into your brain. That's very accurate, and you can see videos online if you search for BrainAble of people, you know, having a robotic arm drinking their cup of coffee, etc. That is, you know, someone who's completely paralysed. But the surface, the skin mounted sensors are improving slowly but slowly. The last time I used one of those to be able to move a mouse around a screen and click, I was having to either calm my thoughts very much to make the mouse go down or think really excited thoughts to make it go up and do some sort of facial gymnastics to make it go left and right. And it was all kind of a...
And let me be a little Veruca Salt and be a spoiled brat and stamp my feet and say, when? I want it now. I mean, when you say imminent, what are we talking here? Months or years or decades?
Oh, absolutely. Somewhere between months and years. Like with so many things, you know, like with autonomous vehicles, that technology is absolutely mature, but it will be years, a couple of years at the minimum, before it, you know, is commercially available and we're able to spend another £5,000 or £10,000 on top of the price of a family car to be able to make it autonomous so that I'll be able to use it as well as my wife driving too.
Robin, I know everyone has GPS now, these past 10 years, but I mean, this just seems like an absolutely crazy step into making the impossible possible.
This technology is very mature. It has been driving around as Google Street View cars, you know, taking photographs of streets around America for the last 3 years. They have some really clever algorithms. So, for example, if they see a ball rolling out from behind a car, they recognise that it's a ball. They realise that there might be a child following, so they'll adjust their driving accordingly. They do recognise street signs. They do recognise traffic lights. You know, they know the rules of the road. They can change lanes. It's very mature.
Do you trust it, guys? Would you actually step in one, Emma?
I'm not very good with change.
I fear change.
Yes, I think I would.
This whole segment must be terrifying you then.
Well, you see, this is it. I love the technology, but I like other people to try it out first. But I think there's an issue with blind people and driverless cars, because I don't think sighted people will trust us in them. So I think it will be a long time before actually blind people get to drive them. I think sighted people will get to drive them a long time before we do, because they'll start off very gently and sighted people will, you'll still need a license and it won't be, the actual controls won't be accessible to kind of put in your destination and stuff like that, and it'll take a long time before anyone trusts blind people to drive, I reckon.
There's an etiquette and a sort of a social acceptance around this, just like with glass. You know, people have to, if you're going into the gents, you have to put the glass up on top of your head so it's pointing up at the ceiling so people don't get worried about what the camera's looking at. And, you know, it's like an acceptance thing. So, for example, there are three states, California, Nevada and Texas, I think, in America now, where it is legal to drive these cars, but you do need to have somebody in the driver's seat. They don't have to routinely take over the technology, you know, to kind of get them out of a hole. We're not at that point anymore. You know, it is very reliable technology, but it will be a while before people will be accepting of there being nobody in the driver's seat. But believe me, it will happen, and I'll tell you why. Because Google Ventures, who are venture capitalists of Google, they have put in $258 billion to purchase 25,000 autonomous taxis for Uber. And Uber are a private taxi company that started in several different countries, and specifically so that they won't have to pay taxi drivers. So these cars will be toddling around without anybody in them when they're going to pick up their fare.
Fantastic.
So it won't be that long.
Ghost cars.
Absolutely.
At last.
Car sharing, parking no longer an issue.
We should also point out, at the risk of this turning into a giant corporate promo, that there are other companies making driverless cars and not just Google.
Driverless cars won't be able to take me into the place where I'm going and help me up to the counter, though, will they? So, you know, driverless taxi, get into the taxi, get there, it just chucks me out in its nearest parking space to where I am, and I'm still left kind of high and dry. But I understand the benefits, but I think there is, you know, you can't be a grumpy, nosy man helping you out.
Could it not be actually sort of safer? I mean, I don't know what the statistics are for autopilot on aeroplanes. We do accept these now. We don't sort of think, oh my goodness, they've gone to autopilot, it's all going to fall apart. Could it be that one day these cars are even safer than human beings driving?
Are safer because they gather all this data, all these statistics about how they're driving. You can compare it to human drivers and you see that they drive much more safely, much more smoothly, much more fuel efficiently. And the only time in the 3 years that they've been driving in America that they were involved in an accident was when a human driver rear-ended one of them. And because they were gathering all the data from this car as it was driving, they could, you know, unequivocally prove that it wasn't the fault of the Google autonomous vehicle, because, you know, that braked, it showed that it braked in a very sort of smooth way, etc. So it was obviously the fault of the person behind. So I'm very confident, very excited.
On the whole, then,
it won't be that long.
The human brain, useless, unreliable, and outdated. I think this is what we can conclude. I'd like to thank Robin for this absolutely fascinating discussion. I know we're going to return to this as technology is just moving at such an incredibly fast rate at the moment. So thank you so much, Robin, and also thank you to Emma, Simon, and Tim for your contributions. Thanks for listening. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and email. Plus, there's clips of past shows up on Audio Boo. It's like we're a persistent stalker with a bad smell. Get in touch and tell us what you think or who you would like to hear us interview and why. Thanks to all our guests and to the team, Emma Tracy and Joe Langton, studio manager. This show was produced by Damon Rose. So before we go, I'm just going to drag the aforementioned Emma Tracy closer to the microphone. Emma, are you close enough?
I am, I
you
think.
Are. So we're playing out with the Fish Police today. Now, we've had these guys on quite a lot over the years, haven't we? So tell me all about them.
We have. We love the Fish Police. We played Fishwater last year and we had some great fun with quizzes with them in the studio. And they played a big part in London 2012 as well. They had a big commission then. They're part of Heart and Soul, a London-based arts organisation. They've got a new album out called The Marzipan Transformations. And this song is called Sabrin, My Very Last Day.
So until December, goodbye.
Blue jeans, t-shirt, black trainers. I was getting ready for my very last day. Had to get to the door by 8. The number one bus was on its way. The Sabrin rolled on the 51 bus and the 51 bus took it all the way. I get to see her one more time, just one more time on my very last day. Green jeans, t-shirt, blue trainers. I remember what she wore. She looked okay, she had them shoes with the white flowers on. They really grew on me, I have to say. When she wore on tiptoes. When she danced, she sway. I get to see her one more time, just one more time on my very last day.
My very last day arrived before I knew for sure what I was gonna do. Tell me, please. Hey, hey, but what do I say? The very first time she spoke to me, never forget. Just why did she say to me something like,
hey, hey, stop looking at me, will you? I had something I wanted to ask her, kinda had something I wanted to say. I had to get her alone for a minute, quick, quick, have to move it, no delay. Miss my chance in the morning, maybe at lunchtime it would be okay. I get to see her one more time, just one more time on my very last day.
My very last day arrived before I knew
for sure
what I was gonna do. Tell me please,
hey, hey,
but what do I say? First time she spoke to me, never forget. Just what she said to me, something like,
hey, hey, stop looking at me, will you? Sabrin, I can see you on the bus, and I am waving hello. Sabrin, I can see you at the table.
shake your head, 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 shake your head. I really didn't want to leave. I really wish that I could stay. I wanted all the butterflies inside my stomach to go away. But it was almost time to go, and I was almost on my way. I get to see her one more time, just one more time on my very last day.
My very last day arrived before I knew for sure what I was gonna do. Tell me please,
hey, hey, but what do I say?
Oh, oh, the very first time you spoke to me, you'll never forget. It's what you said to me, something like,
hey, hey, stop looking at me, will you?
Severin, I wanna see you, you,
see you.
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 I just wanna talk to you. Let me talk to you. Find a word to say to you. Say to you. Severin, I wanna see you, you,
see you.
Severin, I wanna see you, you,
see you.
Bloody
yeah,
robot.
Sure, coming. Yeah,
coming over here, taking our time.
Thanks, guys.